This is the TSN MMA show with Aaron Bronstetter and Bazooka Joe Valtellini.
Darren Till scores a controversial victory over Stephen Thompson. What's next for both of these individuals? We'll talk about it. Michael Bisping calls it a day. Our favorite Bisping moments will be discussed. Is this the end of The Ultimate Fighter? And if it is, what's the most memorable part of the show? We react to new details about the UFC's new TV deal with ESPN and ESPN Plus. And we are joined by Dustin Poirier and UFC Vice President of International and Content, Dave Shaw. And the we for this show is my guest co-host, John Pollock of Post Wrestling. John, I went to patreon.com/postwrestling earlier, and I was absolutely floored by the amount of support that you've gotten from the wrestling community.
Well, first of all, Aaron, it's great to be here, and thank you very much. Myself and Wei Ting, we launched Post Wrestling back in December, and the support we have received has been, it's been staggering. It's overwhelming. We had no real idea of what the level of support would be going from a free content model that we had when we were with Live Audio Wrestling and the Fight Network to launching our own, where we had to think of this as part of like the business component to it. And the amount of people that signed up for it, I look at it that there were a lot of people that just wanted to see this thing get up and running and be able to support this show and this network and keep it going.
You guys turned it around fairly quickly. I love the design of the website and the logo design. I think it's fantastic. And the name Post Wrestling, where did that come from?
Well, that was all the design elements. That all goes to Wei Ting, who spent hours and hours on the site layout. Post Wrestling, like, we had a couple of ideas for names, and we were having a tough time settling on one. I always find that's the most time consuming, is something as trivial as a name. But we wanted it to be able to encompass the two of us, but also have like a broader reach. So it's kind of an acronym for Pollock Offsets Ting. The Post Wrestling, it also gives it kind of a news presentation to it as well. And then when you break it down, it's kind of got a personal element to it as well. And that was, I think we had thrown around a bunch of names, and Wei was out of town driving home, and he was like, Post Wrestling, I think that works. And I was like, let's go with it.
All right, cool.
That was it.
Do you guys do clickbait links like the old wrestling sites did 20 years ago? Like, oh, we have pictures of so-and-so arguing backstage, and then you'd click on it, and it would just go, like, to advertisers?
No, I'm not.
Do they still do that in wrestling sites? I haven't.
Some do.
Wrestling. Oh, really? They still do.
And,
wow.
I mean, there's
a throwback.
There's money to be made, I guess, in that thing. I mean, that's, like, you know, we have limited advertising on our site, and I think that's just by, like, we really want to have a site that is, like, listen, we're not going to become millionaires off of Google AdSense. So I really don't want to make a site that is just so headline-driven and, you know, clickbait for lack of a better term. I really hope people go to the site. And what I like doing is, you know, taking a story and going a bit more in-depth into it. And that's kind of like my writing style. It's my preference. And Wei and I are a pretty good gauge of kind of what is the content we enjoy out there and how can we kind of put our own touch on it.
I was saying to you a little bit earlier that it's kind of like a cable package. You've got your basic cable if you want to just go to postwrestling.com and check out all the different free articles. And then, of course, there's, you know, specialty cable. And then, you know, you get your HBO and you get your super premium content. In fact, you've got a tier of people that pay $50 a month. And apparently they get to watch you and Wei wrestle in Wei's basement in Scarborough. Is that true?
No, that's the unknown tier at this point.
That's coming later.
Yeah. All but right. it was a big thing to us is that when we were launching this, listen, I'm happy for anybody that downloads one of our shows or goes to our website. I never want to exclude people that not everyone's going to want to sign up for something. I wanted to make a lot of free content out there. I think, you know, from a selfish perspective, to try and grow your audience. I think that's a really important part to any website out there, to any podcast network. You want to have a free element to it to gain people. But yeah, I think there's a lot of free content there that if that's all you're willing to commit to, that's awesome. That's great. And then for those that want a little bit more, we have those options as well through the Patreon model at postwrestlingcafe.com.
Yeah, and that takes you over to the Patreon site, and you can go from there, decide, pick your poison, decide what you want to do with postwrestling.com. So I ran into John this weekend. We were both at the screening for Mauro Ranallo's movie, Bipolar Rock and Roller, which is awesome. If you haven't seen it yet, I highly recommend it. We had Mauro on the show recently discussing that. Mm-hmm. And John and I have this in common. We both produced for Mauro, myself for a couple weeks and John for a couple years.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you and I met, was at the Hardcore Sports Radio when Mauro had come over. He was hired by the Fight Network in 2006. And they had brought him over. He had, you know, uprooted from British Columbia to Toronto. And, I mean, this was a network that we were a year since launching. It was hardly, you know, this big professional setup. And there was very little for Morrow to do. Like, they had hired this guy and not really have a set, you know, day-to-day tasks for him.
Hired Big John also. And
oh, there were a lot of hires back in the day.
Loretta Hunt was there.
I mean, yeah, there was quite, it was an incredible amount of talent that we had in those days.
Just nothing to do with them.
I mean, that's funny. Has been the consistent part of the Fight Network is the quality of people up to this day that are there at that network. But getting back to Morrow, we got Sirius launched, and then shortly thereafter that we worked out a deal to do a daily 1 hour show, Fight Network Radio, and I was assigned as Morrow's producer for it, and that gave Morrow his daily task, essentially his daily day-to-day work, and everything kind of went into that show for the two of us.
Yeah, that show was awesome. I loved it, and it was really when I started to get into mixed martial arts. It was back in probably around 08, and you know, a lot of what you guys were doing was the catalyst for that. So I am where I am now because of you guys and because of that radio station really helping.
That station
me get into
was
the sport.
So much fun. Like,
oh,
there
it was awesome.
Like, everyone was just so laid back. It was a different vibe than you get at most places, and it was just it just seemed like there was no red tape. It was just free flowing discussion. You weren't bound by commercial breaks every 10 minutes. It was just I thought really ahead of its time, and I thought it was just you had some tremendous personalities there.
And little known fact, if you're listening to this on TSN Radio Toronto, the host of Overdrive, Brian Hayes, actually got a start there as a
producer.
That's
right. Yeah, that's right.
So we'll use that as a throwback. So this past weekend, Till versus Wonder Boy, a lot of people thought it was a controversial decision. We both watched it, obviously. Give me your take. What did you think when you heard the decision?
You know, watching it, I did watch the fight back, so I did watch it twice. The first time I watched it, I thought that Till had narrowly won the fight. In rewatching it, I kind of scored it the second time, 3-2 for Thompson. I thought round one, round two, and round four were the ones I scored for Thompson. Three was very close with Till. Fifth was obviously the definitive round for Darren Till. I cannot begrudge anyone that scored that fight for Till either. I thought it was a very, very close fight. I guess I'm kind of in the minority. I found it really compelling because it was just so close. Each round, highly debatable, up until that knockdown in the fifth. So I thought it was compelling in that sense, but I also get that that's not going to be everybody's cup of tea either.
Yeah, it seemed like the fifth round was kind of the crescendo, what you were waiting for. Like, when they first got in the cage, I was anxious. It's one of those fights where you're like, okay, anything could really happen.
Very hard fight to break down ahead of time, and I think could have gone either way. I mean, I didn't really have a good grasp of that fight.
Do you ever get anxious watching fights? Like, when they first start, you're like, oh, like, this is... There's like a gravity to this.
You know, there's certain fights that, I mean, when it's a big fight, there's always going to be kind of different levels of anticipation for a fight. I mean, you and I, we watch so many fights every week. I think that there are fewer and fewer that come by that really have that gravity to them. But absolutely, I think, especially being live at a show at times when you get to go out in the arena and be there, I couldn't imagine what it would be like in that arena in Liverpool when Darren Till is walking out. I think that certainly enhances it. But
it comes out the Sweet Caroline, which is the one of the Liverpool fight songs.
Yeah, a tremendous entrance. I think one of the better ones we've seen. And I think that they've had kind of, you know, this as the immense amount of events that they have been putting forward. I mean, I go back to 2 weeks ago. I thought, you know, Damian Maia, that was a really interesting fight with Kamaru Usman going in. That was a really debatable one. We'll probably talk about this coming week with Jimmy Rivera, Marlon Moraes. You know, usually when it comes to the main events, I think that there's a lot of competitive fights that we've seen this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, like you mentioned, this weekend's fight in Utica is going to be pretty crazy. Not a lot of distractions for the folks that are fighting out in Utica.
Yeah, I don't know what the audience will be like in Utica in comparison to Liverpool.
A lot of fans of the Adirondack Railroad. I looked up attractions in Utica because Matt Radmanovich, who works for the UFC, is a PR guy there. He's actually just got hired by Red Bull. I sent him a text congratulating him, and I said, I'm not going to see you in Chicago. And he goes, no, they sent me to Utica instead. So I went online, looked up Utica attractions, and it was like some sort of Adirondack Railroad. I go, okay, well, enjoy the Adirondack Railroad for me.
Yeah, Utica may be the short straw in the promotional assignments.
Yeah, exactly. Not too much to do out there. But, you know, if you need some downtime, you want to catch up on some Netflix shows, it might be good. Although I shouldn't really rip Utica. I've never been there.
I've been, I went to UFC 159 in New Jersey, and I ended up booking
that's the one in Newark, right?
Yeah.
That was one of the most boring cards they've ever done.
This was in Newark, and I stayed at this hotel that was right by the airport, and there was a highway in between me and any kind of civilization, and it was just the worst. I was stuck in this hotel, and it was just either call a cab and spend $20 to get into the city, Newark is a tough stay.
Yeah. Well, you stay in New York, take
I'm doing no favors for the tourism in the northeast of the United States.
I don't know how good Newark's tourism is to begin with. But
well, it's it's a tough one. That's where the WWE will be next year for WrestleMania.
In Newark?
Where
Prudential?
Well, they'll be running MetLife Stadium.
MetLife, okay.
So they'll be bouncing events between New York and New Jersey, but they're in that northeast pocket.
Like they did for the Super Bowl. That's fun. That was one of the worst Super Bowls to ever navigate was the New York-New Jersey one. But I digress. So Thompson says he would have won if he wasn't in Liverpool. I tend to agree with that. I think that, you know, when I watched it, I was like, okay, well, I think Thompson won, but I think Till's going to win because the building was so loud and not a whole lot happened. So every time, you know, Till kicked Thompson and Thompson checked the kick, it's people are loud. So with that in mind, is there something they should do about the judging, or do you think that the live atmosphere is just something that that's part of the atmosphere of these fights and should be taken into account?
I think it's going to be a necessary evil that the UFC will take every time. Is it the most fair of environments for the person that is the outsider coming in? Not really. You would hope that with your judges that they're professional enough that they can kind of, you know, separate that and be watching the fight and be able to see that. That said, I have a really hard time coming down hard on the judges in this particular fight. I think it's razor close. I don't think this was the 249-46 scorecards stand out a lot, but man, these were rounds that, you know, those first four rounds, they're very tough rounds. You don't know the angles they're watching this at, and it does play a difference though. When people throw out the idea of like a hometown decision, like that's kind of silly because the judges are not from Liverpool. But the reaction from that audience where Darren Till may come up short on a jab that the audience is going to treat like it was a knockdown versus Stephen Thompson that's connecting to crickets, I think that does play probably a factor. And you would hope the more experienced judges are able to separate that and see what is happening in front of them to get the most accurate score possible.
Well, my question is, why do the judges need to sit cage side? Like, why can't they just sit in a room in the back with no sound and like in a soundproof room? Not a soundproof room because, the UFC doesn't control the arena. But you know what I mean? Like just sit in a room watching on monitors, put maybe headphones on that block out the sound and get a really unbiased view. So you're not... Because if you're watching from an angle, although a lot of the time they do have monitors in front of them, but if you're watching from an angle and the guy's back is to you, you don't know what's going on. Like a guy could be landing body shots and you wouldn't even see it.
The argument against that would be that when you have sat cage side for fights, like television does not do justice what some of the strikes, how they connect and the severity of them. That's something you would be compromising by taking them away from cage side. I've never been opposed to the idea of having... You know, a split where maybe instead of three judges, it's five judges, like kickboxing,
where it's
going to be much harder to have, you know, an egregious scorecard that if there is one, it's one of five instead of a third, which is the difference between a unanimous and split decision. I think that if you did have one judge that was scoring from further away while you still could maintain cage side judges as well. I think this is all stuff that should be out there and be discussed. It just, to me, is not something that the UFC, to me, they seem very resistant to change. It's very difficult because you're also dealing with athletic commissions. I mean, we can look at the weight classes that have been introduced that the UFC really doesn't want to get away from those core weight classes and mixing around, you know, fragmenting weight classes at 170, for instance.
Yeah, well, two of the main core issues that people seem to have with the UFC were pretty prevalent this weekend with the judging and with weight cutting, because Darren Till misses weight by a pretty decent amount, 3.5 pounds. He goes on and wins the fight. Thompson's ranked number one. Now he's going to move up probably to number one in the rankings. But when you look at even Josh Emmett, when he beat Lamas, he was above weight, and he moves into the top five all of a sudden at featherweight out of nowhere, had just moved down from lightweight. In my opinion, if you miss weight, your ranking should stay the same regardless of a win or loss. I just don't think that you should be rewarded for that kind of thing. You're going to get your pay, obviously. You're not going to be eligible for bonuses. But if you're coming in that much heavier than an opponent, and Till essentially had to cut weight a second time in order to make weight on fight day due to the agreement that they had with Thompson's camp. And same with Molly McCann. She had to be a certain weight on fight day. So you're basically making them do a second weight cut, which is not good for the health and safety of the fighter. So there's just a lot of things that I think, you know, we talk about it all the time, could be changed for the better.
If you go up a weight class and win a fight, should your ranking be improved by your prior weight class? Like, that was not a welterweight fight that we watched. That was a catchweight bout that Darren Till did not make the weight limit, didn't come close to it. And, you know, whatever his reasonings for it, a family emergency, that's fine. But you didn't make the weight. And to me, I hate these situations for the fighter in question, like a Stephen Thompson, who, let's forget the idea that he's already here going into Liverpool, where we just outlined some of the negatives that are attached with that. Much higher ranked guy who is doing a giant favor here for a Darren Till. And then he's put in a position where you either accept this fight against, let's be honest, a middleweight that Darren Till should probably be fighting at, not at a welterweight limit.
He looked like he was 10, 15 pounds more than
he was gigantic in comparison by fight time.
Yeah.
And it's probably 200 pounds, you would say, by the time that fight took place.
And Thompson says the heaviest he ever gets is 85 or 86.
So what is Stephen Thompson to do? He either says no to this, which I would never criticize if he's done everything. This guy has come in at such a higher weight. We've seen the records this year of what happens when a fighter is overweight. And what's the penalty? Yes, 30% of lost pay. But Darren Till, in a fight where this is getting...
But here's the weird thing about that 30%. So Darren Till, let's say he's making $80,000. I don't know. I'm just throwing a number out there. So now $24,000 goes to Thompson. If Thompson's making $150,000 and $150,000, he's, in essence, if he thought he was going to win the fight without any sort of size discrepancy, he's now lost $125,000 of pay that he could have earned.
That's what you've given up. And as well,
potentially,
you're faced with the option that if Stephen Thompson, well within his right to say no to this fight, the terms were not met, you're going to let the main event fall apart. The UFC
in Liverpool.
And what are the repercussions for you going to be? The UFC, they want to put that fight in the cage. They don't care what the weight is going to be. Yeah, it's not ideal, but we want to put the fight into the cage. That is our objective. Stephen Thompson's objective is to have as competitive a fight as possible when you're facing a guy who is ranked eighth and you're number one. So I felt awful that Stephen Thompson was in the position he was, and I feel fighters are really backed into a corner in these situations where you've just done a whole camp and you're going to have no payday at the end of it.
Well, here's the crazy thing that I think. Here's my idea for the weight cutting, and a lot of people, you know, have their own ideas.
I'm open to any theories.
Okay, so here's my theory. You have USADA now, and they're testing these fighters round the clock, year round. Have them weigh them, and if they're they have to be within a certain, like, let's say you're a welterweight, you need to weigh between, let's say, 180 and 190 pounds as your walk around weight, so that you're not cutting a ridiculous amount of weight. You don't know when USADA is going to show up, so it's not like you can cut weight for USADA's coming today. Have them have their walk around weight be conducive to the weight class, because the big problem that and the reason why they have these weigh-ins and they have people cutting all this weight is like a lot of them will just rehydrate to a massive level. And because if you can find loopholes, fighters will always look to find those loopholes. So just have these guys walk around smaller. That's all it would take. Don't you think?
I'd be completely in favor of USADA, you know, monitoring these weights much more closer year round. I think, you know, Stephen Thompson mentioned this week the fact that when he fought Matt Brown, he was walking around at 210 pounds, and he got down to 170. That's insanity to me. Like these,
well, Chiesa and guys like that weigh 190 to 200 and get down to 55.
You know what? That's the kind of stuff to me. It's like you're a professional athlete. I think that, you know, putting on 40 to 50 pounds, that's beyond excessive. And it's you're either in favor of weight classes for a reason to make this to level the field as much as possible, or you're not in favor of weight classes at all, and you just feel that guys can go in there at any size. If you're serious about weight cutting, then a 200-pound fighter should not be competing at 155 pounds. It's insanity to me. I feel that the early day weigh-ins, like, we've gone through this process. We've had the three-year experiment, and to me,
it
has not worked.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked.
They should do it Thursday night, in my opinion.
The theory, there's going to be drawbacks to any scenario. The people that, you know, say same-day weigh-ins, you're not giving enough time to rehydrate yourself, and that's completely valid. If you moved it to Thursday night, there's going to be people saying, well, they're going to put on more weight.
Yeah, they also do media and stuff on Thursdays as well, so they can't really do that in the middle of a weight
cut. To me, it's... I want to hear new ideas. I don't want to be just we're handcuffed to this one idea that for 3 years it's been an abject failure.
Utilize USADA. I think that is the easiest fix. Utilize USADA. You get flagged for a warning if you're above a certain weight. If you're flagged twice, you have to move up a weight class.
You have to be within a certain percentage year round, and you don't know when they're coming. And you know what? If you're a lightweight and you're allowing yourself to get over 200 pounds, you're going to get flagged and come back again. Like, that's just not healthy to me that these guys are going through. When you're talking 40 pounds that they're cutting in the lead up to a fight, it's just excessive to me. And you know, the frightening part, and we've seen in other organizations where weight cutting has led to a death. I mean, if this happens,
several organizations.
The warning signs have been out there. Like, we're discussing this. I just, listen, there's no easy fix, and that's, I think, what's frustrating for people, that there isn't just, hey, we do this, it's going to correct everything. Any kind of solution is going to come with problems with it. I was in favor of the early day weigh-ins when they started. Guys were very much in favor of them. Gives you more time. On paper, sounded really good, but I'm not naive enough to look at the results and see that this has not worked.
It's been like triple the amount of people have failed. You know, it's funny, when I talk to people who don't watch the sport and I tell them I cover it, they go, aren't you afraid someone's going to like die one day in the cage? I go, no, I'm afraid they're going to die outside of the cage during one of these weigh-ins. I honestly think that is a more realistic scenario.
100%.
Because this honestly, it needs to be changed. And to me, it seems like an easy fix. Just monitor these guys. Like, ONE FC has implemented, or ONE Championship, sorry, have implemented a very stringent weigh-in policy where they have to weigh in day of, and they have to check their weight frequently so that people don't fight above their weight class. And I think that is something that makes a whole lot of sense, and that it's not that difficult for them to just monitor these athletes if they're already monitoring and doing drug tests.
What do you think about more weight classes? Because I mean, I see as the fan is not opposed to that, because suddenly you're fragmenting weight divisions. It's more titles. However, if you're looking from a safety standpoint, if we had 5-pound increments between weight classes, I don't know if you'd see the drastic cuts that we're seeing at the moment, where you have big gaps between 185 to 205, 170 to 185.
Well, the negative, as you just mentioned, is that that is going to create a little bit of oversaturation. But the flip side of that is the UFC say they're going to be doing, 46 events per year or whatever it is. More weight class, more champions, more options. You know,
they've shown no hesitation to introduce championships at lower weight classes, creating new divisions.
To me, 55, 65, 75, 85, 95. Even a 95, I think.
I would sign off on that.
And then you might even look at 225, but it seems like the size of heavyweights, you know, if you see a guy like Stipe fight, you know, he fights around 235 to 240 in that area code. And then you see guys like that are 265 at that cut weight, like a Francis Ngannou, it doesn't seem to really affect a whole lot when it comes to the bigger fighters. But 225 could be something too. But then, of course, you're going to have guys that are like weigh 245 that are starving themselves, or 265 trying to get down to 225. So
yeah, but I think in between that 155 to 205 area, I think that it would help to have some more options for guys, because it's a Darren Till, like 185 might be daunting for him, but if there was a 175 class.
Yeah, that same would with Woodley. Woodley cuts a lot of weight.
Yeah, I think that suddenly that becomes more realistic.
And then 165, you've got Rafael Dos Anjos, who could be a great champion. You know, you've got guys like Donald Cerrone, 165 would be perfect for him. Kevin Lee, 165 would be perfect for him.
I don't think people realize how many lightweights are under contract in the UFC.
There's a lot of talent. Chiesa, 165 would be great for. Ferguson, 165 would be great for. Like, and then you'll still have guys like Khabib at 155, and guys, although Khabib probably could move up to 165 also, but what I'm saying is there's a lot of talent and the distribution of talent I'm not too worried about, especially in the male MMA weight classes. I feel like the female weight classes are a little bit thin.
But at least they have introduced flyweight, and we don't have a 20-pound gap now. Yeah, we do have those 10-pound gaps
you've
now.
You've got 145, and there's just no fighters. But they're doing an Ultimate Fighter. We'll see what happens. And I think they're also trying to get some featherweights on the Contender Series. So I don't know. I think it's funny that Cyborg's probably going to be coaching on that show. She'll be coaching opponents who she's called out from other organizations that are coming in, like Pam Sorensen. She could be coaching Pam Sorensen and likely coaching the person that's going to face her in the future. But you know what? These guys are all professionals anyways. These ladies and gentlemen are all professionals.
What a note that Ultimate Fighter will likely go out on.
Yeah, heavyweights and female featherweights.
Yes.
Pretty good. New heavyweights I like, though.
Yeah? Yeah. I think, listen, the series has... You know, it's
run its course. So why don't we go to that?
Yeah, why not? Sure.
Let's talk Ultimate Fighter. I was going to go to Bisping because we were in Britain, but now we've started talking Ultimate Fighter. Dana White kind of alluded to the idea that this next season of the Ultimate Fighter, maybe the last season of the Ultimate Fighter. I personally still watch it and still like it, but I know that I'm in the minority.
This is the first season, actually, I haven't watched. The Cormier Miocic season. Yeah, I was with you. I was watching it for work purposes, but I was watching it all up until... this past season. Listen, I think that it's, to me, it's it's eliminated what its function was initially to be. Not even the 2005 version, but even looking at 2010. When they were on Spike, it was a star-making vehicle for the coaches to put them out in front of 1 to 2 million viewers every week. On FS1, where you're talking about a fraction of that, when we have 200,000 to 300 watching, you're not creating stars. You're servicing the hardest of the hardcore fans at that point. For fighters, I don't think it's the most beneficial if you're a manager putting your fighter into that scenario as opposed to just trying to become...
Contender Series makes a whole lot more sense.
The Contender Series is your avenue, or, you know, like a Shorty Torres. Like, his path was a much more...
Or go to LFA, where it seems like anybody who becomes a champion in LFA ends up in the UFC.
You have so many other promotions that you can make. You can sign much better contracts than the entry-level Ultimate Fighter contract entails. It just is. It's not a series to me that is conducive to 2018 mixed martial arts any longer. And I think the writing was on the wall when Contender Series was able to produce what it did last summer.
I thought that 125 season with the females was a really flawed premise, was giving a championship to the winner of that. I mean, you have Valentina Shevchenko in the UFC and lots of people that she could compete with at 125, like an Alexis Davis. Why not make a title fight between them and then say the winner of the show is going to fight for the title?
I wasn't a fan of them introducing the title when you knew what the...
Yeah.
It made no sense for...
being fed to the sharks.
it financially made no sense for a Valentina Shevchenko to enter the Ultimate Fighter.
Right.
You knew there was going to be sharks at that weight class in time, and there will be. And we're going to get a title fight of Nico Montano and Valentina Shevchenko.
Shevchenko is probably going to be a 10-1 favorite.
Yeah. Listen, there are probably commissions out there that would not approve that fight, and that's going to be
based
a championship fight.
Yeah. Yeah, based on records, I guess Nico is, what, 3-2? If something along those lines? 4-2, maybe?
Yeah.
So, I mean, putting her in there, like, against someone, especially with the pedigree before MMA of Valentina Shevchenko, it just does not seem like a very smart idea.
Yeah, and I think that's
going to happen.
That season is a perfect example of the lack of incentive to go on that show. If you're somebody like a Nico Montano, sure, it makes sense for you, but for the cream of the crop that division was going to cultivate... None of them were going. We saw that with the comeback season. Like, what? I mean, outside of a James Krause who made that decision to go on the Ultimate Fighter, you know, like, that's the caliber of guys that are willing to do a show like that.
A throwaway that season now. Like, who's left from that show? Yeah. Jesse Taylor got suspended. I think Diego Lima just fought and lost, and he's probably going to get let go again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just,
it was such
a
great story with Jesse Taylor,
and then he ruined
such
it. Ruined the whole thing.
A wall he ran into.
What's your favorite Ultimate Fighter season?
Oh, boy. I love the lightweight season in 2007, the one that we got Manny Gamburian and Nate Diaz in the finals. When you look back at the talent level on that season, that was a great season. Certainly, you can't underestimate the influence of the first season when you just had all those personalities. I mean, it was such a pivotal season. The third one with Ortiz and Shamrock, along with the second season where you saw Matt Hughes really emerge, that to me showed the power that this show can have for these coaches. Like, yes, you had Chuck and Randy in the first, but Matt Hughes came in there as, you know, a relative unknown to that large of an audience and came out of it and drew that huge number afterwards with Royce Gracie. Those are the seasons that come to mind. The heavyweights, the season 10.
Yeah, that's the Kimbo season?
Yes.
That's probably my favorite.
Yeah.
That Ultimate Fighter China with... Wang Sai and Zhang.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I mean, changed the game.
Zhang Lipeng, that was a game changer.
Yeah. Those are the seasons that come to mind for me.
The heavyweight season with Kimbo, I think, is that did big ratings. It really helped boost Kimbo in the UFC. And, I mean, Kimbo did get a win in the UFC. You know, you gotta remember that.
A taped fight with Roy Nelson that, if memory serves me correct, did 6.5 million viewers on Spike.
Crazy.
Think about that number.
Think
about what some of these Fox
million.
Specials do, and a taped fight, months old, airs with Roy Nelson.
Yeah, that's close to what they got for the Velasquez and Dos Santos fight. That was like 7-something million, right?
Yeah, I think all told, yeah.
Yeah, they put a heavyweight fight on free TV. That was cool.
Yeah.
That's probably my favorite Fox moment. Is the very first one, the very first one they did, just putting that on TV.
Well, that was, you know, you want to talk about, they put such emphasis on that fight that it just felt like the biggest fight they had ever put together. They put such prestige on with Fox. I mean, dude, Dana White treated that as the biggest show they had ever promoted. And it was, you know, it was
they
over
only
quick.
Showed one fight on TV, and it was like 40 seconds.
I thought those two, they just, the primetime special, it wasn't a primetime, but a countdown that they did ahead of time for it, I believe. They just felt like the two like dominant heavyweights of this generation, and that was such a. I thought the first Fox show, like granted, it was such a quick fight. I thought it put the UFC in such a a great light. Like, here they are alongside all these other sports on Fox, and they made these two feel like a huge deal, and Junior Dos Santos wins the title. It probably was the high mark of those Fox cards.
I keep bouncing between whether that was the biggest heavyweight fight ever or the one coming up with Cormier and Stipe, because it's a champion versus champion fight. Like, I'm still on the fence because that fight, people forget how huge that fight was.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at heavyweight fights, I mean, the rematch with Lesnar and Mir, that was just so big, coupled with UFC 100, which was funny because that was supposed to be at 98, and then Mir got hurt, and they had it just 100 was probably just going to be George and Alves, and then they inherited the biggest fight possible. That was a big one. I love that Cormier Miocic fight. I think that's such a tremendous main event that I will be very happy when they both stand on that scale and the fight is official for the next day.
We shouldn't be too worried.
Not so much the weigh-in represents, but the fact that no one gets hurt beforehand, that this fight is officially happening and we get it on that.
You remember last year's International Fight Week, it was a disaster.
Oh, well, I'm thinking of 200 that week.
Yeah.
Were you there that week?
I wasn't down there, no.
That was the most chaotic fight week I have ever covered. With first of all, the three fights in a row on those three nights was just insanity before all the John Jones stuff occurred. Mm-hmm. That to me was crazy.
You know what? The crazy thing about 200 that still stands out to me is that Anderson Silva and Cormier fought. It just seems like something that could never... feels like it never happened, and B, feels like such a video game matchup that you can't even wrap your head around it happening. And it just, to me, is weird that it happened.
When Daniel Cormier retires, like, how long down the list are you going to go before you mention that he beat Anderson Silva?
Yeah. Like, and this was Anderson Silva when he was still Anderson Silva. Like, he was still a pretty...
I thought that was an underrated coup that the UFC was able to pull off on short notice to get that fight together.
It was like Holloway
together.
Coming in to fight Khabib, but unfortunately Holloway had the weight-cutting issue. But that to me was like, wow, they really pulled a rabbit out of their hat here.
Yeah,
they got Holloway on that short notice.
As much as that card was maligned, both going in and coming out of it, like it was kind of like this downer card because of all the problems. But think of that night that you had Amanda Nunes coming out of it, where she felt really special coming out of that card. It was expected that Brock Lesnar is going to fight again, and then all the stuff happened with him. But, I mean, thinking that, going to the press conference that night, and Brock Lesnar with the biggest grin on his face, the man just seemed like he was so happy to be fighting again. It was like, this is going to be, I think this will be a great night in hindsight. I really thought Amanda Nunes would take off as a bigger star, and then that's before the Ronda fight. Really didn't happen, and of course with Brock, it's still a question mark.
Well, the clock is ticking on if he's going to be able to fight this year. He's got one month to basically declare on, you know, put himself back in the pool, because it's a 6-month waiting time.
He's got to, you know, it's put up or shut up time for him. Yeah. And given where the WWE is right now with their pending television deals next year, I think Brock's in a great leverage position that they are going to want to retain him. He always finds his way into these advantageous negotiating positions.
Yeah. And why can't you do both? I think he could probably do both. I mean, he'd probably have to take a break if he's going to do UFC, but if I'm not mistaken, he's not always on TV anyway.
No,
right?
No. He only does a handful of matches a year. It's all in... Listen, the WWE can pay him whatever they feel the need to. They have $2.35 billion in television money coming over the next 5 years. Whatever they want to pay this guy, they can. Crazy. If they want exclusivity, they can get it on him.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. That's a lot of money. And do you think SmackDown becomes the premium brand? I don't know why I'm segueing to wrestling here, but do you think SmackDown becomes the premium brand because it's on Fox?
I think it's going to need the major emphasis when it launches. But I feel both shows, just given the amount of dollars, you're talking about the A-plus versus the A-show. That's what I look at it. I think both are such high priorities now because of the amount of dollars that are committed to these shows that they're going to want to have their most star power on both. I think it could very well end this brand split because you're going to want to have the access to the most star power available, especially when you're on Fox, where the barrier for entry to maintain that show on Fox, you're going to need to have your viewership higher than what SmackDown averages now.
Well, you mentioned Bisping, one of the original Ultimate Fighter winners, I guess, from season three, like from the early times.
Yes.
Season three, right?
Season three, yeah. Josh Haynes.
Yeah. So he has announced that he's calling it a career. He had complications with his other eye after the...
That was scary.
The Kelvin Gastelum fight, so... That Gastelum fight still leaves a bad taste in my mouth.
I hated it ahead of time, and I hated it afterwards, and I think most people did. You know, he was so confident going into that fight, but it just seemed like a guy on pure fumes after the George loss. That it's an unfortunate ending to his career, but at the same time, it gave him a definitive I should be stopping this now,
yep,
rather than a fight where you come out saying, ah, maybe I can do one more. That was a pretty definitive statement at the end.
It must be hard for these guys to walk away from the sport. I mean, it's all they know.
Incredibly hard.
I mean, Bisping has a lot to fall back on, so he's kind of in an easier position.
Can you imagine someone coming to you, Aaron, and stating that we just don't think you interview at the same level you used to? We just don't think you can do it anymore. Like, think of how you've been doing this for over a decade, and someone comes to you and says that you're just not as good now. You're not as quick on your answer, on your questions. You're not hosting at the same level before. You're a diminished performer from before. You've got to stop this.
This cuts deep, John. We can stop with the examples.
Oh, hey, I'll put it on myself then. But, I mean, imagine being told that, and you've spent to be a fighter at this level, you've got to put all eggs into that basket. Now, thankfully, Michael Bisping has also done television work, but it's a massive psychological hurdle to enter retirement, and it's a reason I think we see so many guys come back.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, look, Chuck Liddell, if I would have told you 5 years ago Chuck Liddell is going to be returning to the UFC or returning to mixed martial arts competition at the same time that Michael Bisping walks away, you'd probably think I was nuts.
Yeah, you know, the Chuck Liddell.
This is something I don't want to happen. It's going to happen, but I really don't want to see Chuck Liddell fight again.
Yeah,
I'll probably have to watch it just for.
Listen, I'm not going to lie. I'm going to watch it, but I don't want to see it. It's. Listen, I've spoken to Chuck Liddell, and it's like, dude, this guy, that's all he wants to do. Like, he loves fighting. And I really don't believe it's financially motivated. I think this guy just, he loves every element of fighting. And that passion comes through with him, that this guy did not want to retire in 2010. He did it kicking and screaming, and now he's got the door open. There's no allegiance anymore to the UFC. That there's a part of me that, yeah, from a health standpoint, from a concern, probably shouldn't be doing it. But this guy is so set on it. If a commission is going to license him, then he's going to do what he's going to do.
You can't really stop him. I mean, it's his decision.
All you can do is share your opinion of it. Yeah. I mean, this is a 48-year-old man who wasn't losing decisions at the end either. I mean, he was getting knocked
losing
out.
Losing consciousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was that will be tough to watch. But again, I think I'm going to have to. I mean, if he's fighting Tito Ortiz, I guess I have to watch it.
At least with Tito Ortiz, I mean, it's not to me the kind of opponent that concerns me as much as if he were facing a 28-year-old striker.
John Jones, for example, who he wants
like John Jones, yes. Which thankfully will never happen.
You can probably guarantee.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, he's like, you know.
Oh, they go
Chuck's
to Japan
like
62, or something.
Chuck's like
I shouldn't,
62,
maybe
John's
I shouldn't say
45.
Never.
Who knows? Please, let's say never on that one, please. I really don't want to. I don't even want to imagine that happening.
Look what Michael Bisping has opened up for us.
Yeah, exactly. Opened Pandora's box with Chuck coming back. Our next guest is the Vice President of International and Content, Dave Shaw. He's had a very busy year and still has more ahead of him as he's got more TV deals to work out. But he was part of the negotiations for this ESPN deal. And he's in Canada right now as they're promoting the ticket sales for UFC Fight Night in Calgary on July 28th. And he joins us now on the TSN MMA show.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to introduce this week's guest.
I'm happy to be joined now by the UFC's Vice President of International and Content and a fellow Canadian, Dave Shaw. Dave, before we get started, on a personal front, has this been the craziest year of your life?
Yeah, it's been pretty intense. Yeah, I mean, you know, we lost a lot of good soldiers, and so there's a few of us who are still around to get some of the work done. And there's been a lot of travel, a lot of events working towards this U.S. TV deal has been a pretty intense process. But we're in a pretty good spot. Looking forward to the second half of the year.
You must be happy to have that behind you, at least the American part of it. You still have a lot of international work to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, quite frankly, we've got a lot of the heavy lifting has been done, but there's still a mountain of other work that needs to be done when we consider we've got to redo all our pay-per-view deals in the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and then several of our international TV deals that we'll work alongside the IMG Media folks on. So, yeah, no shortage of work in the next 6 months.
Absolutely. Well, Dave, the UFC has an event that Dana White has coined as his birthday event coming up in Calgary on July 28th. Tickets are on sale to the general public on Friday. With what happened last time in Calgary, how important was it for the promotion to put on a card that's almost can't miss?
Yeah, well, I believe he's been calling it the ultimate birthday card. So he's pretty excited. You know, we all had a great time in Calgary here up until the fights actually occurred. It was a little stressful last time with the amount of injuries that happened. But, you know, he's taken it on as a, you know, personal mission to make sure that the card is as compelling as possible and that the matchups not only have, you know, the high potential of being, you know, really dynamic fights with exciting finishes, but also taking a very calculated approach at who's actually on the card. Jose Aldo's competing. He obviously couldn't fight in July 2012. We're really looking forward to being here. We've got a huge fan base in Alberta and indeed in Calgary. And for us, it's just been too long, and we're happy to be coming back.
Well, I will vouch for Edmonton. That was a fantastic event last year. Their arena is really incredible.
Yeah, I mean, listen, they've done a tremendous job in Edmonton. I think we will probably keep looking to Calgary and Edmonton as both tier one cities when you consider, some of the other major metropolitan areas in Canada, like Toronto, Montreal, and Vancouver, where historically we've had pay-per-view or, these big kind of FBC, Fox Broadcast types of shows. Coming back here makes so much sense for a number of different reasons.
Compared to some of the other international markets, how healthy would you say the Canadian market is right now, really without a prevalent Canadian contender at this time?
Yeah, I mean, listen, Canada is first of all, it's a pay-per-view market, so it's very important for us. It's a much more mature market, so I think our approach to Canada is going to differ slightly than some other regions that are, a bit more nascent in their evolution of MMA appreciation. Tremendously important for us. I mean, we are hopeful that, people like Olivier Aubin-Mercier is going to continue, his run. This card in particular in Calgary, we've got seven Canadians that really span kind of, west, east when you think of Cajun fighting out of Vancouver. And then you got a couple Montrealers with Olivier and John McDessie. And a few others. So, the approach to Canada is one that we will continue to invest pretty heavily on. We need to work on a new TV relationship, our pay-per-view deals, as I mentioned before, and are going to continue to invest in the sport to make sure that it grows for the next few years.
Will there be a pay-per-view in Canada this year?
Yeah, I mean, our hopeful, we've been very vocal about coming to Canada with three events a year. Pay-per-view is always sort of a tentpole event that we want to have. We are hopeful to get a pay-per-view in by the end of the year. Who knows what George is going to do, but he's definitely expressed interest in fighting again. That could match up really nicely for us. But this event in Calgary on July 28th will be the first event of three events that we're going to have over the course of 2018, and we'll probably mirror that typical or that standard kind of schedule for 2019 and beyond.
You mentioned tier one markets and this being an FBC event, Fox Broadcast. In the new deal with ESPN, there's no mention of ABC. Are there still going to be kind of higher tier Canadian events, but higher tier kind of network style events that are going to be bigger than a lot of the other fight nights with this ESPN deal?
Yeah, so I mean, important thing to first recognize is the ESPN deal is U.S. only. And the way that it breaks down is, we're going to have 42 events a year. 12 of those will be pay-per-view. So ESPN will get those pay-per-view prelims on ESPN Linear. That leaves 30 events. Of those 30 events, 10 will be on ESPN Linear, and 20 will be on ESPN Plus, their digital OTT subscription network. And so why that's important is that we've got a considerable amount of an increase in events that will be on ESPN Linear, which is, a channel that's relatively easy to find. It's a channel that's distributed in many homes across the U.S. And so for us, the ability to get exposure via ESPN's linear channels is a huge, huge opportunity for us. So to your question, when it comes to whether or not we'd have these kind of Fox Broadcast type events, yes, we will continue to have those. There will just be more of them because of the increase of ESPN linear events that we will have.
Oh, great. So the ESPN linear, that sheds a lot of light on that. The ESPN linear events, the 10 of them, not the pay-per-view prelims, are going to be,
correct.
There's going to be a lot of weight thrown into those. And I guess also in the prelims for the pay-per-views.
That's correct. Yep, that's correct. And then I think the other thing to recognize is that ESPN Plus becomes the pay-per-view distributor. So now we've got a TV broadcaster that is incented to promote the pay-per-view events. And we feel that's going to just kind of help lift the level of support and exposure that we've got for our marquee events.
I've seen a lot of international viewers curious about how the ESPN Plus cards will be accessed. And I'd imagine, obviously, international consumers won't have an issue seeing them somehow, some way. But is that package being built to be formatted for digital and not television in terms of the pacing of those particular cards?
No, that's incorrect. I mean, these events are going to be produced as a live TV show And the distribution platform will just be dependent on the country that we're in. So I'll give you a good example. I mean, if you are in the U.S. and you've got ESPN and you're going to watch a UFC on ESPN Plus Fight Night, you will see it on the digital subscription network. If you are in the U.K., you will see it on BT Sport. If you're in Australia, you'll see it on Fox Sports Australia. So we're producing these shows for a live TV sporting event. And the fact is, if you're in the U.S., you'll get it via a digital platform, but you'll also get it through a linear platform if you're in another country where the broadcaster is distributing the event on TV.
Okay, great. That should answer a lot of the questions that I think people in the international community have had about that. So the ESPN deal, as I mentioned, does answer a lot of questions in terms of how the shows, how many shows there will be. But I think there are still a couple things. I acknowledge that you may not be able to answer some of these questions. But card start times, are they going to continue to be 10 p.m. main card starts for the most part?
Yeah, we haven't contemplated any change in time, especially because, you know, we want the kind of appointment viewing of our pay-per-views to be at 10 p.m. Eastern and 7 p.m. Pacific. I mean, you know, people are creatures of habit, and there's this kind of dependencies. I mean, when we shift the time period, we went to 9 p.m. Eastern and 6 p.m., I think, in 2011, maybe.
Yeah, I remember.
And that kind of freaked out a lot of people, and we saw a pretty dramatic shift in the viewership, so that's why we switched it back. We haven't necessarily contemplated any change in the start of the pay-per-views. What is beneficial to the new ESPN deal is that there is a contemplation, or at least some guidelines, on the number of what we're calling off-prime events. So events that if we hold them in, not necessarily Australia, but if we hold them in, say, Asia or in certain parts of Europe, they will be prime time locally. So say this summer, you know, we're going to Hamburg in July. This event will be in prime time in Hamburg to help develop the local market, because if you're there locally, the best time to see the event is in the evening, in prime time. That means that back in North America, we will be viewing these events typically in, say, the afternoon if it's a local event in Europe. And so this kind of opportunity gives us the ability to focus on the growth of the business internationally, which we haven't really had the luxury on in the current deal.
Absolutely. Yeah, that certainly will help those local markets, because I remember there were times where, you know, you'd have it for a 10 p.m. Eastern start, and it would be like the middle of the night there. So that will assist. Yeah.
Well, I'll give you a good example. I mean, last September we were in Tokyo, and we literally had some of our guys, the first operation guys, that showed up at the arena, at Saitama Arena in Tokyo at 4 a.m. Were before the lights were on. They were using their cell phone lights to actually navigate themselves through the venue. And the first fight ended up being at like 7 a.m. or something like that. So not very convenient for a local market, either from a viewership perspective or a ticket sales perspective, but it was great for you know, the U.S. and Canada. Now it'll be switched around where we can help develop these local markets.
And the press release also mentioned that there's going to be 12 pay-per-views. Are the UFC going to continue to use the same pay-per-view model as they are now in terms of distribution, or are there going to be some changes on that front?
No, I think it's going to largely mirror what we've got going in 2018. I mean, we're going to have some of the traditional distributors, cable and satellite distributors in the U.S., you know, DirecTV, InDemand, Ubiquiti, and Dish. In Canada, Bell, Shaw, Rogers, Sastel, and Videotron. You know, in Australia, where there's pay-per-views, we'll just continue to distribute through Foxtel and through Fetch. But we will also see a continued growth of some of the digital platforms, like YouTube, like Amazon, like Xbox and PlayStation, platforms that, you know, while are a bit, you know, relatively new versus some of the traditional distributors, are platforms where our fans are saying, hey, guys, we need to be able to watch pay-per-views through these alternative methods, and we'll continue to foster the growth of those distribution platforms.
And, of course, ESPN Plus and Fight Pass, as you mentioned earlier.
Correct.
It's the rematch between Eddie Alvarez and Dustin Poirier. They have unfinished business from their no-contest fight that took place last May in Dallas. They settled a score in Calgary July 28th on a card that includes former champions Jose Aldo, Joanna Jędrzejczyk. Presale tickets are available now. Tickets for the general public go on sale this Friday. Dave, it's a pleasure having you on the show. Really looking forward to that Alvarez and Poirier fight. Stakes are higher than the last time they fight. We don't know what's happening with Conor McGregor. There could be a title shot at stake.
That's right. That's right. Well, thanks for the support, Aaron. We're looking forward to getting back to Calgary in the summer, and I'm thrilled and really stoked for this Poirier Alvarez fight. It should be a beauty.
That was UFC Vice President of International and Content Dave Shaw. fellow Torontonian.
Great interview.
Yeah, he's fantastic, you know, and he was very, very forthright with me and in terms of the new TV deal with ESPN and ESPN Plus, at least in the United States, and how that affects international, because as the VP of international, I'm sure that a lot of the stakeholders overseas and even in Canada, to an extent, you know, when the ESPN Plus deal was announced, I got a lot of tweets from worried Canadians that they wouldn't be able to get these fights.
But, you and I both, yes.
Yeah. But the UFC are not naive enough to put
what
to
a
put
2018
it just on ESPN
response.
Plus,
how does this affect me?
Yeah, but it's true. You know, a lot of people are like, "Well, we can't get ESPN Plus in this country." But
I think that's totally valid.
We can't get Fox Sports 1 in this country.
Just
right?
want to make sure they can see these cards. There's going to be a lot of them. Yeah,
there will be a lot of them, and those will be televised internationally or potentially on digital platforms, I guess, if they want to go in that direction. But with what Dave said, it seems like they're probably going to target television for the overseas markets.
Right, which I found interesting, the fact that, you know, these are going to be produced as live television specials.
Yeah, so it's kind of the flip side of what a lot of people were saying, because a lot of people were saying, oh, these ESPN Plus events are going to be great because the pacing is going to be better. No dice.
It sounds like we're going to get the FS1 style of presentation.
Yeah, so I mean, as an East Coast viewer, you know what, it's funny. I complained. I was like, oh, man. Our card started at 10 p.m. here, and we, you know, we're up till 2. I wish they made them earlier. And then all these people from the Middle East and the UK were sending me angry messages like, mate, we're up till 4 a.m. You know, we have to wake up at 4 a.m. to watch these cards. And I was like, okay, yeah. I guess you do have a lot worse than I do.
Yeah, it's, well, one of the things that's, you know, some people might overlook is that for a lot of these streaming platforms, and I've seen this firsthand from the WWE Network, is one of the big metrics they push is numbers of hours consumed. Very much incentivizes these services to produce the longest events possible, because you've got a captive audience. Get 7 hours out of them as opposed to cramming it in 4, for instance, even though it, to me, would be a much more enjoyable viewing experience that we see with the Fight Pass pacing.
Yeah, you know, and one thing that this TV deal does that I said in the lead up to the TV deals, I guess, while they were being negotiated, was for ESPN Plus, they're probably not going to put their premium fighters on it. Like, now they can take, if they're going to have those 10 linear events and prelims on ESPN, put your best foot forward for those events. And then if you're a big enough UFC fan, you're paying $5 a month for ESPN Plus. Whatever they put on, I think people will watch. Do you agree?
Yeah, and I find it interesting what Dave mentioned as well, the fact that, and we knew this when the deal was announced, that you're going to be able to buy these pay-per-views through ESPN Plus. So it incentivizes the broadcaster to promote the pay-per-views, which wasn't always it wasn't the dynamic at Fox, where the best fights are on pay-per-view. Where is the incentive for Fox to really push hard a pay-per-view that they don't reap any reward
and
from?
All the ESPN broadcasts can say, you can buy the pay-per-view on ESPN Plus.
Exactly.
Buy the pay-per-view on ESPN Plus and hammer that home, because they're going to get a good cut of that.
ESPN being a broadcast partner in the pay-per-view front, that's kind of a small wrinkle to this deal. That's a very important one.
Yeah, absolutely. And they still have Amazon on board, as well as YouTube and some other distributors, and even Fight Pass you can buy pay-per-views on. So they're just increasing.
Wait, when you order pay-per-views, do you watch on traditional pay-per-view? Do you order it digitally?
I watch it here in the office.
Oh, look at you.
Or I go to the event. But I'm not the best person to ask. But yeah, previously I would either go to a bar or I'd buy it.
Okay, cool.
Before I was covering the sport.
I found a lot have been just buying them on YouTube, and, you know, it's, you know, seamless.
Yeah, you put up the old Chromecast.
Chromecast,
Apple
man.
TV. Yeah.
Game changer.
Yeah,
there you go.
With it looked great, too. It looks fantastic.
Yeah,
because
totally.
I think you can actually get, especially if you have that 4K Chromecast, the newer one, you can get really stellar picture quality that's probably even better than what you'd get on your TV.
Yeah, that's...
As long as you have good bandwidth.
Yeah, we'll
see
what...
That's the catch. But, you know, Bell has fiber to home now, and you can get really fast speeds. I did not get paid extra to say that.
No, there you go.
Pay-per-view model staying the same. We were just talking about that as ESPN
12 pay-per-views.
Plus as an added distributor. It actually is going, I guess, from 13 to 12 technically, because they had 13 previously. But this is the part that I'm not too sure about, because you're seeing a little bit of struggle in terms of selling. Like, look at the one with Nunes in Brazil. Reportedly only got 85,000 buys, which is, I think, the lowest of the Zuffa era.
I think fights like that, those should be on at worst ESPN Plus. If not, you just put them on the linear platform. To me, it's tough. You look at, even at 85,000 buys, it still comes out as, you know, the UFC isn't losing money on a pay-per-view.
Yeah.
But that said, you know, the idea with Fox was that you would put, like, these stars on television that would hopefully propel them to, that you would bring that audience from free television to pay-per-view. We really didn't see that actually apply. Like, there was no one that I can see that was a star developed on Fox that turned into a pay-per-view draw.
Yeah.
So while that theory is there, we haven't really seen it executed. Maybe ESPN will have a different approach to it, because that's the big unknown here, is what the promotional muscle that ESPN brings with it, what effect does that have on star creation, especially when so many shows are on a streaming platform? To me, those 10 ESPN shows are very important. And how many are on main ESPN? How many are on ESPNU? It's like,
well,
it's just linear.
I don't think they're going to do that. I think that...
What if it's a big
ESPN
night of sports?
Shows,
like, what if it's there's
a
conflict?
But I think that they can schedule around that.
You would hope so.
But then again, you have college football on Saturday nights and things of that nature. But I imagine it'll be on either ESPN or ESPN2.
Like, that's the thing. UFC is not the prime tenant on ESPN.
No.
And I don't think
there are very few of them.
Yeah.
Just in general. Like, they don't have a whole lot of... Like, they're really prime where, like, you couldn't bump that from the schedule. Probably college football.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have the Monday night or Monday night football, but UFC won't
be
affected by that.
Yeah.
They don't have hockey on Saturday night. So, and they don't really have primetime basketball games on Saturday night either. So really the only thing that the UFC has to contend with is college football.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if they have college football, you can also end college football at 10. You do a game that ends at 10 and then you go into the UFC with that. And that's actually a great lead in for them.
Yeah.
So there's good and bad with that.
I really thought that for this deal, like, it's the UFC's way that we're just going to announce we're going to do 12 pay-per-views a year. We don't know what those fights are going to be. I think like a more strategic model would be we'll do a pay-per-view when we have the pay-per-view fight. When George is fighting, we're putting it on pay-per-view. But you've almost forced yourself that we've got to fill 12 pay-per-view main events, and thus a Valentina Shevchenko, Nico Montano may be what you're forced to do because there are no other available main event title fights
month. And that's where those divisions that we discussed earlier could come into play if you want to add more pay-per-view fodder. Most main cards will begin at 10 p.m. Eastern like they do now. So I don't know if that means less 8 p.m. starts like they had for those Fox cards, or if maybe the linear ones could begin at 8, but they'll probably begin at 10 p.m. if I had to guess. Top Rank's been doing really well for them in those later spots at ESPN, and I think Top Rank actually played a very big role in the UFC and ESPN's marriage, because Top Rank has been getting great ratings with a younger demographic, and that's really what they're trying to do, is lure that younger demographic, as all TV providers are, TV networks rather. And of course, you've got the ESPN Plus deal, as you mentioned, giving flexibility for international shows to start in their market's actual prime time.
That's a big bonus.
I
completely agree. I don't think it's at all unsatisfying to your North American audience in lieu of going to new markets. Like, how are you growing that audience if you're going to Shanghai and you're doing these shows in the middle of the night?
And the good thing about the North American time is that there aren't a whole lot of time zones where you're going to be starting at like 1 or 2 a.m. for the most part. I guess if it was in China or Japan and you're on the West Coast, maybe, but... You know, the North American viewers will be able to jump onto that.
Yeah, it's like it's when you hit like Japan or Australia and you realize that these guys are coming to the arena at 7 in the morning, or as we with Michael Bisping and Dan Henderson. I mean, here's a middleweight title fight happening at 4 in the morning in Manchester.
Yeah,
that's the stuff. Yeah. I agree. For these international markets, you want to grow and to strengthen these TV deals. Like, if you're paying a lot of money and you're BT Sport, I don't want my product to be airing at this hour. You want it to be, you know, to that primetime audience. So I like that change.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely going to help things. So those are some pretty big, you know, it really adds some clarification to a lot of questions that people had. And I'm glad that Dave was able to clear that up.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a card this weekend in Utica. Actually, sorry, this Friday. TSN2.
Friday night card, yes.
The odd Friday night card for really no reason that I can muster. But Jimmy Rivera versus Marlon Moraes. In the main event, it's good to see Marlon get this kind of opportunity in the main event. He was a lot of fun to watch with the World Series of Fighting, and really a guy that I think can be a contender in this division. And, of course, Rivera's been undefeated for, 10-plus years, I believe.
Yeah, since, second pro fight?
Yeah, along those lines. One of those situations, like Cyborg, who lost her first fight.
Yeah, yeah. This is a great fight. I think this is a really, really competitive fight, not all that different from what we saw last Sunday going into it. I think that five rounds, I think that's going to really I feel it benefits Jimmy Rivera. I think that he's just a really, really durable striker. But, I mean, with Marlon Moraes, like we saw with Aljamain Sterling, like unbelievable knockout power that he does possess. And, I mean, these two will be on the short list for a bantamweight championship shot, especially
absolutely.
If we get a decisive winner.
Yeah, or a fight with Dominic Cruz or something along those lines while we wait to see what happens with Garbrandt.
There's a lot of interesting stuff going on at 135. I really like this fight.
Yeah, and it looked like the division was going to get sidetracked with Demetrius fighting Dillashaw, and that didn't come into fruition, so... That trudges along because we've got in LA August is Dillashaw and Garbrandt. Has Mighty Mouse fought this year? I don't think he's fought in 2018.
No, he hasn't.
He hasn't. That's odd for him. Usually he's very active. I know he got injured, but hopefully we'll see him again soon. Apparently, him versus Cejudo is what has been discussed for a little while. And I like that rematch.
Yeah, I mean, the first fight, it just seemed, you know, that that devastating knee to the body just crippled Cejudo. But,
Cejudo's gotten way better since then.
His striking is, you know, at such a higher level than even his entry at
Nobody's
the UFC.
Nobody's talking about weight with him anymore either. He makes the weight consistently.
That's right. He's consistently made it. And if you're not doing the Dillashaw fight, I mean, that's kind of your options at 125.
So we did get sidetracked a little bit there, but a couple things that stand out to me about this particular card is you've got Daniel Tamer on the main card and David Tamer on the preliminary card. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, the two brothers. I mean,
yeah, except one has fared well and one hasn't. You got them flip flopped. Sometimes I just don't understand the placement of some of these cards of some of these.
This really looks like a kind of like redemption kind of card for some of the like Jessica Aguilar who came in with all that momentum and that really wasn't realized. I mean, Jose Torres is fighting in the opener
that
on Fight Pass.
Why not put him on TV? He's a fun flyweight to watch.
Yeah, I mean, Gleison Tibau fighting on this card. Nick Lentz. I mean, these are some stalwarts. Jake Ellenberger and Ben Saunders. That could be a fun fight,
a fun
or that could be a
that's a good one for the main card. I like that fight.
I think that one should be a lot of fun. In particular, I think Ben Saunders
and Ciara Eubanks makes her official debut, I believe, for the UFC because she didn't make weight last time when she was supposed to fight. Who was it again? Oh, against Nico.
She was going to fight Nico in the finals.
Yeah, so she hasn't had an official UFC fight yet. So that'll be good. I thought she was a real standout on that show, and she was would have been favored against Nico. So she's got a good future if she can make the 125 cutoff.
If, yes.
Yeah, it is a big if. She was making it on the show, and then when she actually has time to make the weight, she's not able to.
Yeah, well, so there was the one episode, though. She had to cut her hair.
I remember. She got her hair.
Like, it was a struggle to get down there.
And Lauren Murphy, who she's fighting on this card, was kind of stalking her to see if she was going to be able to get it, you know, sneak back into the competition. And I think that's probably why this is kind of a fun fight.
The funny thing is, okay, granted, I get it's ridiculous. It's 20 pounds. How far would Ciara Eubanks be from a featherweight title fight if she fought 20 pounds heavier?
Well, not. I mean, how many contenders are there?
She might win one fight.
Right now, she could probably just get the shot.
She might be able to get the fight instantly.
Yeah,
like that's what the featherweight division is. You,
well, I mean,
you raise
Holm
your hand, you're
Negan
getting
Anderson,
the title fight.
So that's probably the next contender. But are they going to do the Holm fight again?
So then you have one fight. That's what you're looking at for some
Holm,
of these fighters.
Holm almost won a decision in that fight. That's when judging would have had to be turned on its head.
Right.
Like, I thought that Holm won the fifth round.
Mm-hmm.
If the other judges had given her the fifth round, she would have won the fight. Like, and I guess two of the judges had her winning. I think it was 1-2 or 1-3. It's crazy.
Yeah,
that would have been the worst decision in the history of the organization, I think.
Oh boy,
we've got Matt Hamill and Bisping, which was controversial.
Oh, what was that awful one with Diego Sanchez a few years ago?
Oh, Diego Sanchez, Ross Pearson,
and Ross Pearson.
Yeah,
that one.
And
immediately
then there was another one
mind.
With Diego that I don't remember offhand, where he was gifted a decision, but that one was terrible.
Yeah, there's a. Yeah, that's my go-to of at least the last couple of years. Every so often we get one of those.
Yeah, and then there was the there have been some in the title fights. Like I thought Woodley beat Thompson in that first fight. It was a draw, so it wasn't necessarily a terrible decision. But I thought Woodley decidedly beat him in that fight. But oh well.
Yeah, that was a really good fight, that first one. I mean,
you
had the two extremes of those two fights.
Yeah, the second one just fell on its face.
Board in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Well, oh, no, that one was in
Vegas.
That was
the Vegas 209.
Yeah, and then Ramdeen and Paul and Robin, your colleagues watched it with me. It was actually right before they got let go. They got let go, I think, two days
later. That's right. They were there weekend.
They were trying to argue with me that it was a great fight. I was like, no, it wasn't. Like, of course, Ramdeen appreciates the beauty of the sport to a degree that very few others can.
Ramdeen's never seen a bad fight.
Yeah. Ramdeen has never. That's a good way of putting it.
Yes.
Unless it's like, you know, some sort of street fight. And yeah, he might still like that. I don't want to put words into his mouth.
Got free tickets to some amateur wrestling tournament in like a university in Toronto, and I said, "Hey, you want these tickets?" And he was just so excited to go watch like university amateur wrestling. And
they don't make them like Rammer.
Oh, he's the best. I love Rammer.
All right. Well, before we call it a day, we do have Dustin Poirier on the show. He's in the main event of UFC Fight Night in Calgary, July 28th. Tickets on sale to the general public on Friday, and we appreciate his time. It's always fun catching up with Dustin, and he joins us on the TSN MMA show right now. I'm now joined by one half of the main event for the Dana White birthday supercard, or whatever he wants to call it, because it's an excellent card. Calgary, debt paid, because we've got Dustin Poirier and Eddie Alvarez in the main event. It should be a fun one. Well, I guess we kind of know it'll be a fun one. We saw the first one, unfortunate how it ended, but now we're back on the rails. Dustin, how much did you want this fight?
I wanted it a lot. I wanted it immediately after the other one, but we went our separate ways. He got earned a victory. I earned a couple,
and here we are, back full circle, and this fight means a lot to both of us.
It seemed Eddie was, I guess, hesitant to take the fight on multiple occasions. What was that hesitation?
Because he felt what these hands could do, I think.
Do you think it was anything contractual, or do you think that
I think it was a little bit contractual, and, you know, the news came out he didn't come to a new agreement with the UFC, so he's fighting his contract out here in Canada. With this fight, he's betting on himself, so his back's against the wall, and I know he's going to come very prepared, and, you know, he's going to be the most dangerous Eddie Alvarez we've seen.
Whose fight with Justin Gaethje was more fun, yours or his?
I think mine.
Definitely the fight of the year so far. I mean, Justin Gaethje, like, you just know what you're going to get. He's going to walk forward. He's going to throw punches. He's going to throw kicks. How much did those leg kicks hurt? Because those look painful. You don't see a lot of guys throw leg kicks from that close. You see guys like Tom Dukinwah in the bantamweight division, but Gaethje seems to have a real knack for getting in close and then throwing a leg kick, which is a pretty sharp weapon.
Yeah, he's a solid kicker, probably one of the better kickers that I've ever fought in my career. And when you're a southpaw and you're fighting an orthodox guy, so you have an open stance, the inside leg kick, to me, I feel like does way more damage than an outside leg kick. Just the inside of your leg is more tender and not used to getting damaged like that. The outside of my leg has been kicked for years. That's where most people kick, and it's conditioned to that. The inside of my leg just wasn't prepared for that. He was quick and set him up smooth. I just couldn't get in the rhythm of checking them, and I paid the price, man. My leg it still hurts.
Well, I do this show with Joe Valtellini, so you don't need to talk to me about leg kicks. He talks about leg kicks more than anybody I've ever heard. It was his big weapon in kickboxing, and he talks about how effective it is.
Yeah, especially inside, man. They're more dangerous to throw because of the chance of your opponent checking them and you hitting the knee. Obviously, you've seen what happens in the Anderson Silva-Chris Weidman fight, but when they do land, they do a lot of damage.
So based on how those felt from Justin Gaethje, is that something that you've worked on to improve as part of your game?
You know, I've always been a kickboxer, but I'm still developing my kicking game and trying to catch it up to my boxing. But I'm getting better everywhere. You know, I'm working more on the defensive part of that, obviously, after a fight like that. But that's what happens, man. You go out there, put it all on the line, and learn lessons, and go back to the drawing board and try to tighten up.
You had Eddie in a lot of trouble in that first fight. But he was able to, you know, do what he always does. He's resilient. He comes back, and he comes back strong. Were you surprised by his tenacity there, or is that just something you come to expect when you're going to fight a man like that?
No, that's what Eddie's known for. He's, you know, the most dangerous when he's hurt, when he's against the fence, when he's down and out. That's what you expect when you fight a guy like Eddie Alvarez. He's done some amazing things in his career, and, he's had a great career. A lot of championship belts on the wall at his house, I'm sure. A lot of big organizations he's been to the top of, but now it's my time, and I'm going to put him away here in July.
Do you think Eddie might have the toughest resume of any fighter, not just lightweight, but fighter, if you look at what he's done over the last, I guess, 7-8 years?
I mean, he's fought the toughest, he's fought the top of the top, you know, for the last 10 years, probably. I grew up watching Eddie Alvarez fight in Japan and stuff like that on HDNet back in the day, and he was a guy who I always looked up to, and here we are about to fight again. So, and I owe him one. So when you owe a man, you have to pay him.
It's pretty crazy. If you look back since he fought Pat Curran in 2011, so that's over 7 years ago, was in April. Everybody he's fought except for, I think, yourself and Patricky Pitbull have been like champions somewhere in the world, which is just it's just a crazy resume.
Yeah, no doubt about it. He's the toughest they come.
So looking back at your fights, you did have a loss. I guess your last loss was just under 2 years ago to Michael Johnson. But otherwise, in lightweight, you've done a great job, and you've been one of the toughest guys to beat. And I know lightweight is where you're going to stay. I've asked you about moving back to a featherweight, and you basically said it's completely out of the question. Do you think that at the lightweight division, you're just going to be swimming with sharks for the next couple of years? Is that just the way that it is?
I mean, for the rest of my career, I plan to be swimming with sharks. I'm at the top of the division. I'm only going to go higher. After I beat Eddie here in July, I'm going to fight for the world championship. And after that, it's the top guys, one after another.
So you're looking at this as a number one contender fight. Have you heard of anything in terms of when Conor McGregor could be coming back, if he's coming back, or what the deal with that is? Because if he's not, it seems like the winner of this fight is next in line.
I 100% believe that the winner of this fight is next in line for a title shot. I'm not sure what's up with Connor. Even if he comes back, I believe we're next. Well, we'll see how it plays out. You know, there's talks of GSP coming down and getting the title shot. We'll see what happens with Tony Ferguson. Connor might come back. It's a little bit of a mess, but I'm focused on my fight, and the division will clear itself up.
I know that fighters have to stay focused on their next opponent. That's just the way it is. But the week leading up to UFC 223, with the thing that happened with Ferguson, with McGregor, you know, with Max Holloway, how hard was it to not get distracted from the task at hand with Justin Gaethje? There must have just been so much going on and so many people hitting you up with everything that was happening that particular week.
Definitely, it was. And it was the week before my fight. I gave Dana and Sean Shelby a few messages on, you know, I text them a few times, let them know I'm available. I'm already on the East Coast. I'm close to weight. I'm here if y'all need me. But everything happens for a reason, and they didn't want to break up the fight we had on Fox the next week. You know, they would be fixing one problem and creating two problems. So, and that's not my style. I don't want to fall into a title shot, or I don't want to be a second pick. I don't want to, you know, be plan B. I want to earn it, and that's what I'm going to do here in July.
It seems when you look at Khabib's resume over the last couple of years that he hasn't had it as tough as a guy like Eddie Alvarez or yourself. Do you feel like, you know, he's still yet to be really challenged by anybody or face somebody who will pose a challenge? I mean, I know he beat Rafael Dos Anjos pretty convincingly, but anybody else come to mind?
I thought the fight with Gleison Tibau was a very close fight and a tough fight on both guys. But, his resume in the UFC, he's done great things, beat some good guys and shut some guys out. But I've been fighting the best guys over and over again. You know, I think I probably have two or three times the fights that this guy has in the division. In the UFC. But that's that. You know, he's where he's at, and he's the world champion.
After he beat Iaquinta, I asked Dana White if Khabib is the most dominant fighter to ever fight in the UFC. He's never lost a round officially. Basically, you know, he's gotten finishes. He's done a lot to put himself there. If not for injuries, his resume could be even better than advertised. Do you agree with that? Do you think he's the most dominant fighter in UFC history, or is there somebody in your opinion that has been more dominant than him?
That's a tough to call. I'm not really sure. I mean, he's definitely dominant, but he doesn't have the tenure of these other guys that would be up there with him. You know, the more you fight, the more opportunities there are of chances for things to happen. You know, the more you get hit with shots or you to lose a round. So we'll see. When he fights another five, six fights, then we can circle back around to it. But if you're talking about legends in the UFC or the top guys who've been most dominant, these guys have lots of fights and have fought lots of different opponents.
It seems George St. Pierre is starting to enter the fray here. He told ESPN recently that he's looking to fight the winner of Khabib and Conor, or one of the two of them, because he thinks that's the only thing that will help his legacy at this point, is winning a title in three different divisions. What do you think of George trying to make his way into the lightweight division? Do you think that that's going to stall a lot of things for fighters like yourself, like Kevin Lee, guys that are getting wins and working their way back up to the top, and even a guy like Tony Ferguson, who essentially had his interim title taken away from him?
100%. I mean, if he comes down and gets an immediate title shot, it's going to put everything else on hold. We'll see. We'll see. It's interesting, man, because he's definitely paid his dues. We'll see what happens. I don't want to look too far into it.
If he came in and hypothetically won the title and gave it up right away, do you think that that would be problematic for the UFC, or do you think that that could set up, you know, maybe a gigantic lightweight tournament with guys like yourself and Gaethje and Alvarez and Khabib? You know, there's so many guys that you can name in this division that are really championship caliber.
I'm unsure, because he just did it in the middleweight division. He came and won it and you know, gave it back. So we'll see what happens. They didn't do that there. They just kept it moving with the next two guys. But that's really, you know, shooting far ahead.
We spoke earlier about Till and Wonderboy. You said you had scored the fight for Till. What was it about his performance that gave him the nod in your eyes over Thompson?
I thought he landed a more damaging shot. His aggression, he walked Wonderboy down the whole time. I'm not a guy who scores every fight off of that, but when you have a 5-round fight and one guy's backpedaling the whole time, and nothing big happens, I just feel like the other guy wins. You know, the shots weren't big shots, or they didn't do damage. The shots that Wonderboy did land, you know. I'm all about counter fighting and making your opponent miss, but you have to make him pay when you make him miss, and I just think Wonderboy never did that.
I scored it for Thompson. I had it 48-47, but I saw the level of outrage afterwards when they said it was a terrible decision. There were 14 total fights on average per round among the two of them. There just really wasn't a whole lot happening. I think that people need to temper their outrage for situations like that where you look at that particular fight and really not a whole lot happened. The only real significant moment came in the fifth round when Till dropped Wonderboy.
Right. I mean, when nothing happens for the whole time, I kind of, if you judge the fight as a whole and you say who won the fight, I mean, Wonderboy got dropped in the fifth. Besides that, nothing really happened besides a lot of backpedaling and a lot of missed shots. So I just kind of lean that way.
You can say the same thing with the Tyron fights. The first Tyron fight was a draw, where I thought that Tyron had won pretty decidedly. And then in the second one, it was really just a point fight. And a lot of people thought Thompson had won. But again, with that style that Thompson has, you know, it seems like he's coming out and crushing guys that he's way above. But when he gets to that top level of competition, he plays it really, really conservatively. And that's probably not the best strategy when you're going into a championship fight.
Right, right. Yeah, a few of his fights have been very hard to judge. But that's just the kind of fighter he is. He doesn't take a lot of damage out there. And that's his point fighting and background. And, you know, I'm not mad at him. He's keeping himself safe.
It's hard to be mad at him. He's probably pound for pound the nicest guy in the history of combat sports.
Yeah, he is a nice guy. Sure.
All right, Dustin. Well, you've been very nice to me today. I appreciate all of your time. Enjoy Calgary. Tickets go on sale. UFC Fight Night in Calgary, July 28th. You can get tickets for the general public on sale on Friday. If you have a pre-sale password, they are on sale now. Again, thanks for your time, Dustin.
Thank you.
That was Dustin Poirier, and that's it for us. John, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure, Aaron. It was a lot of fun to chat with you.
And, of course, you can go to postwrestling.com. And if you want to join the Patreon account, it's patreon.com/postwrestling or postwrestlingcafe.com.
Yeah, you can go to either. Join the cafe, and we'd love to have you.
I like how you guys did the Tim Hortons structure. I impetus of that.
I mean, we talk about coffee so much on the show. We just figured let's go all in on the coffee theme and kind of beyond just being, you know, just a kind of stale Patreon. We want to make it kind of like a theme.
Are you guys big coffee drinkers?
I'm a massive coffee drinker, as you can see
here.
Do
you have an AeroPress?
I don't have an AeroPress. Do you recommend it?
Yeah, you got to get in the AeroPress game.
TSN, by the way, folks, has a built-in Tim Hortons.
Yeah, we have Tim Hortons in our building.
See, when we did live audio wrestling here for years, it was Sunday night, so all this stuff was closed. It's another world here in the middle of the day on a Wednesday afternoon.
And there are people, actual people.
There are.
Although the newsroom would have been full when you were there.
You know what? I used to wander over to the editing area because on Sunday nights there would be one person at a computer, and it was James Lynch. And I would come over, who I worked with at the Fight Network, and I'd just chat with him for like 20 minutes and then go back to the radio show. So yeah, that was
James Lynch.
One of the warm bodies here late on a Sunday night here at TSN.
Yeah, we've all done it. If you've been in this industry, you've probably worked late at some point.
Oh, yes.
I used to produce.
I do it now.
I used to produce till 2 a.m. on radio, yeah.
Oh, man.
Every day. John, thank you for coming in. I appreciate it. And we'll be back next week. Joe should be back after a great glory card this coming weekend.
Thanks for listening to the TSN MMA Show. For all the latest UFC news, visit tsn.ca/UFC.